This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Let's begin with a word of prayer. Lord, we pray that you would use this time together this evening to drive home to our hearts the implications of your Lordship, that we might understand that you are indeed are the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Help us to see what this means in the political arena. Help us to see what this means with respect to our Christian walk and our obligations toward our society. Lord, make us more faithful servants so that the gospel in its power might be evident, that the kingdom of our Lord Jesus Christ might be advanced in this age. We pray that this class hour might be used toward that end, so that we might indeed be working for the glory of our God. For it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Before we jump back into last night's lecture, I thought that it might be of some interest to you to hear what the New York Times said last Wednesday about the 200,000 evangelical Christians that were marching on the Christian Capitol for the sake of praying for our national leaders. This is Date Post Washington, April 29th. It says about 200,000 evangelical Christians marched and prayed in downtown Washington today for God's intercession in what one of their leaders called a world of flame and sin. The crowd on the mall exceeded the 178,000 who gathered for the visit of Pope John Paul II last fall. The organizers said they were trying to avoid political involvement in the two-day gathering here, although it included mass lobbying on Capitol Hill yesterday. Ted Pantaleo, one organizer, insisted that the lobbyists had been told only to love and pray for members of Congress. In response to persistent questions in a meeting with reporters at the National Press Club, Mr. Robertson denied that secular matters had been a motive. There is one ruler over the affairs of man, God Almighty, he said. Every leader in the city holds his tenure only so long as God wills it, and they have no authority except as God gives it to them. So the Congress and the President are secondary to us, and God was here today to hear us. There is other portions of the coverage that I'm not going to be reading for you. Let me turn to the back and continue. Okay. They were somewhat jostled, apparently, by members of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a Maoist faction, and demonstrators from homosexual activist groups protesting their fundamentalist criticism of homosexuality as a civil right. Okay, here are these people that are trying to pray for our leaders, you understand? Okay. Now then, James L. Farmer, founder of the Congress of Racial Equality, called his own news conference to say that, quote, if the Jesus I knew were looking down on the mall today, he would probably feel compelled to say, thank God I am not a Christian. Okay, Mr. Farmer said, we must fight to defeat their use of religious rhetoric to conceal their right-wing objectives. Okay, there is further coverage, but I want to continue here. Reverend Jim Baker, host of the televised Praise the Lord Club, told the cheering crowd, quote, America has one last chance. I believe it's time we honor the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and put him back at the head of the United States. God help us to put the Bible back in our schools and our public life, and may we truly be one nation under God. Okay, Dateline the 29th of April, Washington, AP. A group of Christian, Jewish, and secular leaders charged today that organizers of the evangelical rally have, quote, a hidden political agenda for this country, which includes defeating the proposed Equal Rights Amendment, restricting abortion, opposing homosexual rights, eliminating welfare programs, and blocking affirmative action. Okay. Reverend David Eaton, minister of All Souls Unitarian Church in Washington. There is something a little self-contradictory about that, All Souls Unitarian. Some of these says, quote, some of these persons have hoarded millions and millions of dollars and seek to completely ignore the social gospel. They seem to have no understanding of what it means to help the poor in this country. Rabbi Richard Sternberger, director of the Mid-Atlantic Council, Union of American Hebrew Congregations, said, "We challenge those," this is a Jewish speaker, "we challenge those Christians who have come to Washington this week to Christianize government." But I couldn't help but think that this is a good jumping off spot for a discussion of some of the terrible confusions that beset the minds of people when it comes to Christianity and politics. It almost appears that these evangelicals who have come to Washington to pray, as they say, for their leaders, can't please people on either side of the fence. They're damned if they do and damned if they don't. If they come saying, "We are not being political, we're only here to give prayer support for our leaders," then what we are told is they have a hidden agenda. And horror of horrors, it's a conservative hidden agenda opposing such things as homosexuality and abortion. And after all, if they do oppose such things, they're not saying that they do, remember, but if they do, just because they're praying, apparently, we must condemn them. You know, Jesus wouldn't have anything to do with these people because they have no concern for the poor. One wants to know how you get across that huge gulf between we're against homosexual rights and abortion to we have no concern for the poor. And of course, they can have a concern for the poor because some of the people who came may have been millionaires. The non sequiturs involved in this line of reasoning, and this is the sort of thing that in the New York Times is portrayed to people without any sort of correction, mind you. It isn't as though the reporter says, "Would you notice that it's a Jewish rabbi that says we ought to Christianize government, which is to say, bring the social gospel to government?" One of the reasons we're having these evening sessions this week is so that we might be able to draw distinctions that will keep us from making the kind of fallacious judgments that are found in the comments that have been made here. Now, of course, in saying that, I am by no means putting a blanket endorsement over everything that the PTL Club may stand for, or Pat Robertson, or all that. There may very well be legitimate things to criticize. However, I don't think that what got into the paper could count in any reasonable person's mind as being legitimate criticism. They are fallacious criticisms based upon really a stream of consciousness way of thinking, that if you stand for prayer, then of course you stand for conservative causes, which is to say you hate the poor, which is to say you're not on Jesus' side, and all sorts of things. Hopefully, this class, even if you don't end up agreeing with the outlook of the professor on detailed issues, or even fundamental issues, this class will at least allow you to draw distinctions when it comes to these matters. Well, that by way of whetting your appetite for the evening lecture. Let's continue where we were last night. We were considering the question, what is the proper function of the state? And by the end of the period, I had discussed two basic views, that of the state has as its proper function legal regulation and direct welfare. Okay, the view of Jacques Maritain, most liberal Protestants and Roman Catholics. Okay, then secondly, we looked at the view of Carl F.H. Henry, who I think speaks for the most part for conservative evangelicals. And I don't mean to say you have to be politically conservative to be an evangelical, that's another question. But those who are conservative, I think probably Henry speaks very well for them, in saying that the state's job is legal regulation, not direct welfare. In fact, Henry has a chapter which I think very excellently states his own position anyway, and that has to do with the difference between justice and love in biblical perspective. And he says that the idea that agape is the duty of the state leads directly to the totalitarian tendencies that worry us all, and that we need to learn that the job of welfare is that of the church, and the job of justice, legal regulation, is that of the state. Okay, now tonight I'm going to jump in then at the third position, which we haven't discussed yet, the idea that the proper function of the state is legal regulation and the stimulation of social justice. And this is going to be set over against direct welfare. The aim is the same, to see welfare, economic welfare brought to people, racial balance and all the rest, or racial integration. However, the state doesn't directly do these things. It stimulates social justice. Okay. So the third major view of the proper function of the state to be developed by Christian thinkers in this century is what may be called the law and social justice view, or legal regulation and stimulation of social justice. Now this has received perhaps its finest expression in two particular thinkers in this century, Emil Brunner in his book Justice and the Social Order, and Hermann Dooyeweerd in the third volume of his New Critique of Theoretical Thought.
Adelbert may not be a common name to many of you, so first of all, Emil Brunner, you all know, of course, is the leading Neo-Orthodox thinker, and then Herman Adelbert, who is a Dutch Calvinist. Can you all read my handwriting? D-O-O-Y-E-W-E-E-R-D, Adelbert. Now, Brunner and Adelbert have also expressed their alarm at the totalitarian state exceeding the state's proper function, exceeding God's ordering for the state. The thought of them both is in good measure shaped by their attempt to work out the limits of the state's proper function. Brunner says, quote, "The monstrosity which bears the name of the totalitarian state has at last succeeded in reminding us that there are not only primal rights of individuals and of communities, but that there is a just and unjust order of the state itself. The totalitarian state is not, like a dictatorship, a form of the state. It is the absorption of all institutions and all rights by the state. The totalitarian state is the inevitable consequence of the view that all rights obtaining among the people issue from the state. The totalitarian state must of necessity come into being wherever political thought is centralistic and all organization is regarded as issuing from above, from the state center." Adelbert remarks that, quote, "In whatever shape the absolutist idea of the body politic is set forth, it does not recognize any intrinsic legal limits to the authority of the state. This idea implies an absorption of the entire juridical position of man by his position as citizen or as subject of the government." Okay, but at the same time that Brunner and Adelbert expressed their alarm over the totalitarian tendencies in modern states, both also express their conviction that the state is charged by God with the function of promoting social justice. Okay, central to the thought of both is the vision of a well-ordered society as being what Brunner calls a federal society. A federal society, that is, a society whose institutional fabric contains a large number of distinct autonomous institutions. Okay, a federal society, many distinct institutions found in the social fabric. Brunner's federal society is obviously similar to Maritain's pluralist society. Remember that language from last night? The pluralist society Maritain is promoting. Now, Brunner's federal society is obviously similar, and it's interesting that there should be this coalescence between Catholic and at least ostensibly Reformed thinkers. Yet, their two views cannot be identified, if only because Maritain is hazy as to the nature of his pluralistic society. Maritain clearly thought that the church and the family each have a proper function within a definite domain, and that consequently each has an authority not derived from the state and rights to be protected by the state. But Maritain can be read as saying that all institutions except these are subordinate to the state. His recommendation that the state grant each a considerable degree of independence can be read as having no deeper basis than what is good policy in most circumstances. On this crucial issue, Brunner and Adelbert are clear, however. They hold that the institutional fabric of a well-ordered society will contain a great many institutions having a proper function within a definite domain, each of such institutions accordingly possessing both authority in that particular domain and rights which ought to be respected by the state. The institutions of society are not purely instrumental and contractual. And so Brunner says, in the Christian understanding of man, communities are just as much established in the divine order of creation as the independence of the individual. They are innate in the God-created individual with his capacity and need for completion. Thus, it is not the proper function of the state to make educational decisions for society, nor is it the proper function of schools to make business decisions for society. Each of these God-ordained institutions has autonomy in its own domain, sovereignty in its own sphere. Now, that may be a convenient catchphrase for you. This is the view of sphere sovereignty. Okay, each one of these social institutions has its own sphere or domain and sovereignty, autonomy within it. The state, too, is sovereign, but like every other institution, it is sovereign only in its own sphere. Hence, even the standards of justice, I'm quoting now from Brunner, Even the standards of justice obtaining in these forms of community are antecedent to the state. They are formed in manners and customs, agreements, contracts, rights, and ceremonies, established rights to which, in the first instance, no state pays heed. It is not the state which sets this life in motion, not the state which determines by which rules it shall proceed, not the state which can pronounce on its justice or injustice. The state, in all this, comes late, protecting, preserving, regulating, but not as a creative or a constitutive agent. Well, what then is the proper sphere of the state's action? What is the domain of its proper function? And the answer for both of these men is a twofold one. The state's proper function is to regulate the activities of the members of society, both institutional and individual, by a system of laws that is based on good order, that is, regulative justice. So legal regulation is the first proper function of the state. And secondly, the state's proper function is actively to promote social justice. The phrase actively promote is the crucial one here. When at all possible, the state is not itself to provide the services and engage in the activities which will satisfy our benefit rights. Okay? Mark Twain had said the state can go ahead and just dole out the money to the poor. Direct welfare. Bruner and Doyevaert are saying that the state is to actively promote taking care of the poor and other such matters of social justice. For remember, in all its actions, the state must respect the autonomy, the sovereignty, of the other institutions in society. And now, a quote from Doyevaert. The state may promote the interests of science and fine arts, education, public health, trade, agriculture and industry, popular morality, and so on. But every governmental interference with the life of the nation is subject to the inner vital law of the body politic, implied in its structural principle. This vital law delimits the state's task of integration according to the political criterion of the public interest, bound to the principle of sphere sovereignty of the individuality structures of human society. That's a mouthful, isn't it? Later on, I'm going to be talking about Doyevaert in a little more detail. Simply, what he's saying is that every one of the spheres of society has its own vital inner principle, its own determining principle of its sphere of domain or sovereignty. And the state has got to guard that. It's got to guard going beyond its own principle of authority. So then, perhaps we have a way out, a way between the conflict between position one and two. Perhaps what we have here is a third way then. You have legal regulation and direct welfare, or just legal regulation. No, these people say legal regulation and the stimulation of social justice. Yet insofar as possible, the state must not itself become a service institution distributing all sorts of benefits. That would violate the principle of federalism. Its fundamental role in the area of social justice is instead that of actively promoting a federal society containing non-state institutions which satisfy the genuine benefit rights of the citizenry. Doyevaert says, a real public legal integration of a country and people is therefore only possible within the internal limits set by the structural principle of the state institution itself. This integration can only be accomplished within the juridical limits set by this structural principle to the competence of a body politic, and with due regard to the internal sphere sovereignty of the other societal structures. Every political theory denying these limits is in principle a theory of the power state, even though it masks its absolutization of the state's power by a law state ideology. Is this a solution to the conflict between one and two? Well, the view obviously needs a good deal more elaboration than we can give in this class, the short colloquium that it be. However, I would like to point out at least a couple of elements of this theory that might begin to cause us pause in evaluating it. The theory does not imply, according to its authors, does not imply that the state may not use its taxing powers to support non-state institutions. Okay? that if this view does not exclude the idea that the state can use the power of the sword to collect taxes, which taxes will go to non-state institutions as a way of promoting or stimulating social justice. Secondly, these authors do not think that their views imply that the state may never render anything which can be regarded as a service, as they do believe there are certain direct services the state can supply. Let me give you some examples. The maintenance of a system of good roads might be considered a service that is justified by the principle of good order. It makes possible for the fact that citizens can go about their tasks more easily. And it may be that a certain benefit rights can only be supplied by the state directly. For instance, the benefit right of a decent income to the disabled. Okay, so it turns out that though they speak of stimulation of social justice, they do believe that it's possible that the state could directly tax people and then give taxation revenues to other agencies. They also believe that there are certain direct programs the state can engage in. Now, the reason I'm pointing this out is I'm beginning to wonder if there isn't a hole in the dike. Okay? If it isn't the case that though these two positions are trying to stay separate, then in principle, what we have here is a crack in the door or a hole in the dike, whatever metaphor you want to use, and then we're getting right back to the direct approach to welfare, too. Although there are very strong statements of principial limitation upon the state that you don't find in Morris Haynes, nevertheless, they are allowing certain direct promotion of programs, or I don't want to confuse you with that vocabulary. They're allowing the state to get engaged in certain direct support of programs that goes beyond simple stimulation. We're taxing for the sake of non-state organizations, perhaps, and we're providing certain services, perhaps decent income for the disabled. Okay. Now, before I go on to give my own, well, I'm going to be talking about the second issue up here, and then I'm going to be giving my own views. I want to make very clear before we get to that point that our American legal structure does, to a gratifying degree, I think, recognize the domain autonomy of many non-state institutions. And insofar as that is true, one might say that in principle, the legal structure we have in America is resistant to totalitarianism. And for that, we must be thankful. Yet, undoubtedly, our state has been drifting in the direction of becoming more and more an entrepreneur and distributor of services in a multitude of areas. And for this, there are many reasons. No doubt, some of those reasons are insidious. I rather think there are some congressmen who believe the state should encroach more and more upon private schools, upon our homes, and so forth. However, it would be wrong, glibly, to say that in every case the right thing for the state to do is to resist itself acting to secure social justice. Bruner, although he's not my favorite author, does state well the predicament to which we as Christians must be sensitive when he says, "The fundamental Christian realization is that the state has only to intervene where individuals, families, free social groups, the churches, the municipalities, cannot perform their task. Any justice created by the state is a makeshift, a substitute for the justice which human society should create of itself. And vice versa, the greater the decline in the moral vigor of society, the more tasks the state must take upon itself, and the greater the expansion of the element of compulsion in justice, the nearer the approach of the totalitarian state. Hence, the rise of the totalitarian state is in the first instance quite simply a judgment on the wretched moral condition of modern society. We must not fear to add a judgment too on the Christian church and its powerlessness to direct the moral forces of society in the sense of the justice of creation. Let us take as an example the welfare work of the state, which has already assumed monstrous proportions. This would not have been necessary if the family, in the narrower and wider sense of the word, the social community, the Christian community, and the economic community of labor have not so conspicuously broken down." I don't know of any other quotation in all of Bruner's works that I've read that I agree with so much as that one.
Okay.
You will find when I come to expressing my views that I do have Carl Henry's view primarily in mind. Although, if we could understand the stimulation of social justice as not having these cracks in it leading back to direct welfare, I think something could be said for the state promoting the idea of charitable organizations doing their work. The state can create circumstances under which that becomes more feasible for people to do this sort of thing. However, what I want to say is, for whatever disagreement I have with the welfare state, it is first and foremost a judgment of God upon our society that the state does this rather than the family and the church and an independent charitable organization. Had the families and our churches and our independent organizations been doing this, the state never would have had a place to step into. And now that it has, my friends, it's going to be dreadfully hard to drive it out again. Although I'm not going to cease as long as I have breath to make the effort. You have a question?
Yeah, in terms of coming back and stimulating social justice in a private organization and the state having a proper function in stimulating that, how far do they go in regulating that?
Well, I'm not answering any detailed questions of that. I'm only speaking in broad principles right now. I'm saying if one thinks of the stimulation in such a way as to guard the state from getting involved in direct welfare so that you don't have the door open to this voracious state now that becomes almost totalitarian in time, then I don't have too much difficulty with this view. I only said that by way of anticipation of what I'm going to be saying in a few minutes about my own conclusions. But I want to point out that we have to accept the fact that the welfare state today is a judgment on the church. The church didn't do its work. But now you're asking how are we going to guard against the state getting involved in direct welfare.
They come in and they regulate private nursing homes. Or they come in and they say, you have to conduct your private school with so many different kinds of regulations.
Yeah.
To be then accredited by the state, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. My own conviction is that is not right. The state has the right by the law of God to regulate certain matters of safety. For instance, the railing around the roof of the house is the paradigm example in the Old Testament. However, that doesn't give us the right to go ahead and just regulate every aspect of the life of the house or of the organization, the business, the school, the health care institution, what have you. That's my own conviction, but the details we just can't possibly talk about, at least not yet. But I understand the problem. I'm thinking, the kind of stimulation I'm thinking of here, just to give one example that's rather obvious, is that the state can create conditions more conducive to social welfare if churches, charitable organizations, schools, and so forth have tax exemption. Okay, so that the work of these organizations can go forth without the tax burden that other profit-making organizations have. That would be an example of a stimulation of social justice that doesn't amount to the state directly taxing people and paying it to non-tax institutions or taxing people and directly doling it out as welfare.
I wonder if, putting it on, if it extend the definition of state.
We're going to be coming to that question in time.
I think that's crucial to the institution, very definitely.
Yeah.
And maybe in general.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about that. I'm pretty sure exactly what you're looking for is in tonight's lecture, if we get there.
Do you think that even if the church, Christian community were interested, they can assume all responsibilities of managing the welfare needs of the country?
Yes.
You really feel that?
I don't have any doubt at all. There's no difference between the state and the church when it comes to manpower. I mean, if the state can do it, why can't the church do it? The difference is the state can do it a little more forcefully in that it can put you in jail if you don't pay up. The church has to depend upon preaching the gospel and appealing to the charitable heart of men and so forth. But if men working under the rubric state can take care of all of these poor people around the country, by the way, I don't happen to think they're doing that at all. I mean, we can talk all we want in principle about welfare, but as a matter of fact, the poor are very poor still. Now, I don't believe the state is helping the poor in near the grandiose way that the theory talks of. But anyway, if a number of men brought together in offices around the country that have governmental titles over their door can do it, Why can't men sitting in the same offices with church titles over their door do it?
Sure.
No, not taking tax money, taking voluntary contributions.
You're saying because people won't contribute, perhaps. Well, there was a day in which, and we're getting down into the issues now, but let me just quickly say, and then we're going to come back to this. We have a whole unit on welfare that comes up, I believe, Thursday evening in my outline. The church used to do this. I mean, the tithe barns used to make adequate supply for the poor in the community when people got wiped out by fire or something like that, and the disabled. And it used to be that the elderly were taken care of by their families. I mean, what we have got is a society that's become hedonistic and selfish. And again, to what degree does the church bear responsibility for that? I'm saying the church, if we're doing its whole job, preaching the whole counsel of God, the gospel, appealing to the needs of people, insisting upon the tithe and all the rest, I believe the church could be properly doing the work of welfare today. Yes, I do. I used to be, but I'm not anymore overawed by this idea that only the state can do it. Because it just has to dawn on you, look, the state's no more than people. Those people can be church people as much as they can be government people. Right?
Yeah, I have a comment. Even if the church couldn't do it today, let's just say that it was impossible for the church to do it, it still doesn't mean it's the right of the state to provide.
Yeah, that is the most elementary question, whether the state has the right to coerce charity. And we'll be coming to that as well. And I think fundamentally that's the error.
About a couple weeks ago, we had a social science kind of pastoral ministry here. And he talked about, I think it was on the sound of legal regulations so much, that everything, he particularly pointed out health care here in America should come under the state, all regulations under the state specifically. He was speaking primarily against profit.
Against what?
Against profit, profit maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I think
that's it.
The church would be a lot
of meaning.
Is your view similar to that?
It doesn't sound like it. No, my view is not similar to that at all. In the first place, I'm not against the profit motive. As a matter of fact, I think the Bible encourages us to do our best to make as much money as we can. The Bible also tells us to use our profits for the health of others. And not selfishly. But, I mean, we can hardly be in a position to help others if we just become poor like others. And so we ought to do our work to the glory of God and try to make as much money as we can. Legally, fairly, not by gouging people and all the rest. But, I mean, we ought to work hard and make money. And we ought to take the money we got and support our families and support as many other people as we can. So, I mean, I believe in charity. I have a very strong view of Christian charity. And I believe that the profit motive supports that. Moreover, I don't believe the state is competent to make the decisions that, I don't care whether he spoke in this institution or elsewhere, whoever is saying this, I don't believe the state has the competence to make educational, medical, economic decisions. And I think that the history of the state's growth in this century bears me out at every single point. We have not got yet a bureaucratic department of the state whose success is recognized by everybody. The state just doesn't do a good job when it comes to these things. It's not competent to do these things. Moreover, it is not legally empowered to do these things, given the regulatory principle of the state that I'll be speaking of once we get to it in the lecture. And so, again, I'm anticipating. Well, I'm not jumping these questions. We're going to be coming to the heart of these things, and you're going to have plenty to shoot at when we get there.
We've been surveying varying views of the state, perspectives on the state.
Right.
My question is, does the a textbook by Harold Brown, The Reconstruction of the Republic, which we have not yet gotten, survey the varying Christian views of state for us?
Okay, Paul discerned the enslaving tendencies of our actual state. He saw how they forced us into living lives alienated from God, even to the extent of setting up themselves as idolatrous alternatives to God. So much is empirical, if you will. Just by looking, you can see that the state does this. But behind these phenomena, Paul saw demonic powers at work. This for him would explain how a state could become like that depicted in Revelation 13, a beast out of the sea with power and rule and great authority conferred on it by the dragon, demanding that men worship it, blaspheming God, waging war on God's people, and grasping for universal authority. Now these enslaving powers, these enslaving cosmic demonic powers, were conquered by the cross and the resurrection of Christ. It must be said emphatically that Paul does not see the work of Christ as consisting merely in the revelation of God's law, his will, nor does he see it as merely the salvation of few individuals from the burning, nor even does he see it as merely the creation of a new community of the church. Rather, Paul sees Christ's work as including the conquering of the powers and of placing them at the disposal of God. Christ, on his cross, he says, quote, discarded the cosmic powers and authorities like a garment. He made a public spectacle of them and led them as captives in his triumphal procession. Colossians 2:15. The binding of the powers means we can look forward to the reconciliation of all things through Christ. For through him, God chose to reconcile the whole world to himself, making peace through the shedding of his blood upon the cross, to reconcile all things, whether on earth or in heaven, through him alone, Colossians 1:20. But the day of total reconciliation has not yet arrived. When it does arrive, then comes the end, when Christ delivers up the kingdom to God the Father, after abolishing every kind of domination, authority, and power. For he is destined to reign until God has put all enemies under his feet, 1 Corinthians 15:24 and following. In the meanwhile, the mopping up operation and skirmishes go on, though the battle has been essentially won by Christ. Okay, Karl Barth says, in Christ, the angelic powers are called to order, and so far as they need it, they are restored to their original order. Therefore, any further rebellion in this realm can, in principle, only take place in accordance with their creation and within Christ's order in the form of unwilling service to the kingdom of Christ, until even that rebellion within the boundaries of the kingdom of Christ is broken down in his resurrection and parousia. The demonic quality of the powers still exists, but even the demonic powers are now instruments, albeit unwilling ones, in God's order. What follows when all this is applied to the political angelic power? Clearly this, that that power, the state as such, belongs originally and ultimately to Jesus Christ. The state can, of course, become demonic, and the New Testament makes no attempt to conceal the fact that at all times the church may and actually does have to deal with a demonic state. From this point of view, the state becomes demonic not so much by an unwarrantable assumption of autonomy, as by the loss of its legitimate relative independence, as by a renunciation which works out in Caesar worship, the myth of the state, and the like. We should add that in the view of the New Testament, in no circumstances can this demonic state finally achieve what it desires. With gnashing of teeth, it will have to serve where it wants to dominate. It will have to build where it wishes to destroy. It will have to testify to God's justice where it wishes to display the injustice of men. So says Karl Barth. So, when we return to Romans 13, it does appear to have a very different view altogether, doesn't it, than the traditional one. Paul says there that the authorities are instituted or appointed or ordained by God. In all likelihood, what he means, say the proponents of this view, is that they have been ordered or placed in order by God. They have been subjected to Christ's lordship. By virtue of Christ's work, they have been placed, willingly or not, at the disposal of God in the working out of his purposes. They are now God's agents and servants and his ministers, usually, no doubt, unwittingly so, but working for our good by restraining evil and making it possible to lead a tranquil and quiet life in full observation of religion and high standards of morality, 1 Timothy 3:2. Thus, these authorities deserve our subordination, not our unquestioning obedience, but rather our subordination. We must give them their due, no more, no less. So Paul, in speaking of God's ordering of the state, is probably not speaking of some decree of creation, nor is he speaking of some decree of providence. He is speaking of what God has done and is doing in our actual history by way of Christ's work. And what that means at the deepest level is that we must always view the state with a dual attitude. We give thanks to God for the tranquility which the state ensures, but at the same time, we must regard our states with a watchful eye, seeing to it that they retain their place in God's ordering, and that they do not, by overstepping their bounds of proper function, move in the direction of totalitarianism. That is, we must beware of the danger of the state becoming a demonic, beastly state. And neither democracy nor any other form of government is insurance against the state doing just that. Okay. In just a few minutes, we're going to take a 10-minute break, and between now and then, I'd like to say a few things about my own particular convictions on these two basic questions. I think it's important, while I give you something, you know, a wedding stone against which to work, even if you disagree with me, that I set out before you the options and the arguments pro and con so that you can make your own decisions in an intelligent and informed way. We've looked at the proper function of the state. We know those who say and argue that its function is that of legal regulation and direct welfare. Those who say it's only legal regulation, and those who say it's legal regulation and the stimulation of social justice. With respect to the place of the state in the ordering of God, we know those who say it is a creational order, those who say it's a providential order, some who say it's a Christological order. So the state has its place because Christ has put the powers in order. Okay. Now, if you look at the first question, you'll notice something that is very interesting. All the views agree on one thing. Everybody agrees that the state must engage in legal regulation, that the state must deal with matters of crime and punishment. It must order our society so that justice is preserved. Okay? This is not, if you will, a conclusive or necessarily a strong argument, but it's where I'll begin my consideration. It's of interest to me that there's no question in anybody's mind about this. The other question comes in is whether the state should engage in benefit rights, and if so, how so? By stimulation or by direct provision? Okay? These questions arise outside of this common core that everybody sees, that law and order is the work of the state. Now that in itself suggests something to me, that most Christians see that the Bible's view is that of legal regulation. However, it is far from clear that the Bible really does support a coercive use of the state's power to provide welfare or even the stimulation of welfare and social justice. What we need here to decide whether we're going to go beyond this box, if you will, whether we're going to get beyond legal regulation, is what we call a regulative principle. Can anybody remind the class what a regulative principle is with respect to Christian worship? What the function of a regulative principle is?
We must worship God as He has commanded us, and not according to our imagination.
That's right. The regulative principle is used in the Church of Jesus Christ to determine what is and what is not a proper part of Christian worship. Because all Christians are obliged to worship God if the leaders of the church, the elders of the church, or the pastor of the church introduces into Christian worship a matter that is not ordained of God for worship, and God's people are required to worship, then they are introducing into the realm of requirement what God has not required. And therefore, there's the need for a regulative principle of worship. Now, in Romans 13, Paul speaks of the powers that be, and I don't think he's talking about demonic powers, that he speaks of the powers that be, the rulers of the state, as ministers of God. He speaks of them as ministers of God. And they are going to be making certain claims upon our lives. They're going to lay certain duties upon us. They're going to rule us in a certain way. And if they're going to rule us as the minister of God and not the minister of Satan, they're going to rule us as ministers of God and not as the beast of Revelation, then there must be some restraint, some regulation, some principle by which the state knows what its proper bounds is going to be. Okay, so we ask ourselves, what is the regulative principle for the state? What is the regulative principle for the state? Now, if the regulative principle of the state is stated, is expressed, and by it we can find in Scripture that the state is to engage in welfare or at least the stimulation of social justice, then, you see, that settles it. But until you know what the regulative principle for the state is, you will not be able to decide between these views. Okay? And so in stating what I think the regulative principle for the state is, you have to consider whether you think this is the correct principle. Because until you have the correct principle, you will not be able to answer this question. But lo and behold, I warn you, do not start with a view of one, two, or three, and then try to decide on the regulative principle of the state. You see, that's arguing in a circle. That is, if you will, rationalizing, knowing the conclusion you want, and then looking for a principle that will get you there. You see, we're not just looking for a ramp whereby we can run right up to the view we want. We're looking for the regulative principle, and then we're going to look at the regulative principle and see which of these views is the correct one. All right, now my own conviction is that the regulative principle on the state is the law of God. That God has given to the state certain powers and withheld from the state certain powers, even as he's given to the family certain powers and withheld from the family certain powers, even as he's given to the church certain powers and withheld from the church certain powers, and that we know what these things are because God has revealed them in his law. Okay, what if somebody says, my son insulted me, and therefore I'm going to kill him? And it's my right, I'm his father, I can discipline him in any way I see fit. We'd say, wait a minute. The state has withheld from the family the power of the sword. God has withheld from the family the power of the sword. Now what if the state says, well, you know, this guy didn't pay his traffic fine, we're going to execute him. Wouldn't you argue the same way? The state has not given you the power of the sword to execute those who don't pay their traffic fines. That would be terribly unjust. It would be cruel and unusual. It would be excessive. It would be totalitarian. Well, I suggest that the same manner of reasoning is called for in every disputed question of state power. What has God given to the state and what has God withheld from the state? Okay, so the issue here becomes that of God authorizing matters for state power. Second step in my answer is I don't believe that God ever authorizes the state to engage in matters of welfare. Now that's a far cry from saying that God does not command welfare. We went through this last night. Have we forgotten? That welfare is called for, however, it isn't put within the domain of the state. That is a matter of social ethics, to be sure. It is not a matter, however, of political ethics. Now, I had not introduced that distinction before, but if you will follow that distinction, it will help you, I think, ferret out certain things. We can study political ethics. We can also study more broadly social ethics. Now, many Christians tend to conflate these two. They speak of social ethics, and then they go right on to speak of political ethics and nothing more. But there is a difference. Social ethics has to do with all of the duties God lays upon his people in the realm of society. Those duties include our attitude toward people of other races, our support of the poor, and such matters. But it's another question altogether whether those duties are political duties. What distinguishes political from social duties? What is the distinguishing mark of the state? I want to suggest that Paul tells you very clearly that the mark of the state is the sword. For he bears not the sword in vain. Okay? Punishment is the proper domain of the state. The regulation of those who are evil by means of the coercive power of the sword. And so when we want to answer the question whether the state has the right to engage in certain social duties, such as welfare, say, education, health benefits, what we have to say is, does God authorize coercion in the provision of these benefits? Are these benefits actually right? Are they right? Of course, if they are right, then not to provide them calls for punishment. And that means the sword can be used to provide these benefits. If it should be your view, as it is my view, that they are not benefit right, they are benefit, pure and simple, that is to say, matters of charity, therefore they do not fall within the realm of right, they do not fall within the realm of coercion, and they don't fall within the realm of politics. Am I going too fast? I don't hide the fact that if you follow this, you're swallowing a lot of political theory and a lot of biblical exegesis along with it. I happen to think it's justified, and I'm willing to defend it. But I'm telling you, we're settling some very fundamental issues and when I talk this way. I'm arguing that the regulative principle of the state that keeps it from becoming demonic, that keeps it from becoming beastly, is the law of God. That's the first step in my argument. Now, you want some justification for that, I trust. Sola Scriptura, right? Okay, let's turn to Revelation, the 13th chapter. Revelation 13, John, of course, is describing the evil ruler par excellence, the beast. I will not engage in eschatological argumentation here as to whether he's talking about a past political figure, a current political figure, or a yet future political figure, because we all agree as Christians that he's talking about a political figure, wherever he happens to be in history is for another class. Okay, now this political ruler, this evil political ruler par excellence, is described in Revelation 13, and let me get the exact verse, as using the second beast of the earth to insist that people write upon their forehead and upon their hand the name of the beast. Verse 16, and he causes all the small and great, the rich and the poor, the free and the bond, that there be given them a mark on their right hand or upon their forehead, that no man should be able to buy or to sell, save he that hath the mark, even the name of the beast and the number of his name. Very well-known concept. In Christian eschatology, the mark of the beast. I won't get into all the disputes possible as to who the beast is, what the mark is, and all that. But notice how the beast uses his mark to determine who can engage in the marketplace, who can take some part in normal commerce, if you will, who has, if you will, rights within the society. Now, where does the mark of the beast go? On the forehead and upon the hand. Now, John's writing to people who are biblically sensitive. Unfortunately, many popular eschatological writers are not so biblically sensitive, because the mark of the beast, the most important thing about the mark of the beast is not the mark itself, but where it goes, on the forehead and upon the hand, on the forehead, between the eyes, so that everything you see is governed by the state, and everything you do is governed by the state. As a matter of fact, the Old Testament law of God had said that already there should be something on the forehead and upon the hand of a godly person. What? The law of God. The law of God. God's law should govern the way you see things and evaluate things. God's law should govern the way you do things. God's law is to be upon your forehead and upon your hand. But the beast, you see, is a beast just because he wants to put his mark in the place of God's law. He wants to replace God's regulation with his own regulation. Okay, so there is a lot more that can be said and will be said later, but there I think it's a clean justification that the regulative principle to keep a state from becoming the beast is that God's law is governing. Okay, now the second step is to ask yourself whether the law of God authorizes the state to use coercion to take care of the poor and to stimulate social justice and provide welfare, all these things. Okay, let's start with education. Does the state have the right to educate? To determine, if you will, what goes into the head of young people. Stop and think about it. If the state has that power, it has large powers indeed to determine how young people should think. Well, who should determine how young people should think, according to the law of God? The family. And, of course, the family should determine that if it's a godly family in terms of the law of God. But nevertheless, even if it's not according to the law, it's the family that has the obligation for what the young people should think, not the state. And so there you see where the beast can be reined in if you don't give the state the power to educate. How about the power to tax so as to take care of the needs of people? Well, if the state has the power to take care of the needs of people, it has the power to determine what the needs of people are, and it has the power to determine who are the needy. What should happen if the state should decide that when black people are hungry, they aren't really people? Now you say that's a reprehensible view, and I agree. As a matter of fact, it's one that's been held often in history. But when the state is given that power, my friends, then it has the power.
Who does God give the right to take care of the poor to? The charitable organization of his people, the Levites, the deacons in the Christian church. They are charged by God to do so. And you see, when they do so, it must be according to the standards of God in terms of the grace of Jesus Christ. The cup of cold water is offered not as a cup of cold water. It's offered as a cup of cold water in the name of Christ, not in the name of a messianic state, in the name of the Messiah. And therefore, if the regulative principle is the law of God, and if the law of God does withhold from the state the power to tax for the sake of the poor, the power to regulate ideas in our young people's education, then therefore the social duty of education and welfare is not necessarily a political duty. And I want to add to this, and then I notice that we must stop for a break. I want to add to this that the state is obliged to treat all people fairly and equally. Okay? And if it's going to treat all people fairly, it cannot regulate, it cannot recognize benefit rights. I'm going to reverse the logic of many people who believe in benefit rights. They say, if we're going to treat everybody fairly, then that means everybody's got to have a fair amount. Okay? Everybody's got to have basically the same resources. I'm going to argue to just the opposite conclusion, that if we're going to treat people fairly, then we've got to let people have the freedom to do the best they can in social and economic mobility, that the state cannot provide for people. All right? Here we have Mr. B, who is poor. All right? He does not have as much to live on as Mr. A. Okay? Here we have Mr. C, who does not have as much to live on as either Mr. B or Mr. A. And here we have Mr. Z, by the way, who has more to live on than either Mr. A or Mr. B or Mr. C. Okay? Mr. C, we say, is really in a bad way. He has the right to have a supplement to his income. It makes no difference that his family didn't educate him, didn't insist upon him learning his things, did not discipline his wife, let him hold down a job, so forth. We're not talking here necessarily about people disabled now. We're talking about people who are unemployable. Mr. C goes to the state and says, it is my right to be benefited with more money. Well, if it is his right, then that means it's somebody's duty. Pay up. Okay? And now if we have a contract, if you contract with me, or I contract with you, so that I'm going to give you a certain amount of money if you do a certain deed for me, okay, let's say if you build a room onto my house, okay, you build the room, and then I don't pay, it's my duty. You have the right to that money, to as much money as we contracted for. And if I don't pay, you can go to the state and say, he has well done his duty. That's not my benefit. That's his duty. I've earned it. Okay? If this guy goes to the state and says, it's my right to have this money, correspondingly, that means it's somebody's duty to pay him. And what I want to know is, how does it become anybody's duty to pay him money? How does it become anybody's duty to pay him money? Is it because he has done something for the benefit of somebody else and therefore, by contract, should gain the reward of his work? No, he hasn't done anything. He's unemployable. He may not even be known by the others, Z, A, and B up on the board. Now let's ask ourselves, whose duty is it to pay? Well, we all know the Robin Hood philosophy. It's Mr. Z's obligation, obviously. He has more money than anybody else. And he obviously can give up a lot more money than anybody else. But it does seem, doesn't it, that if it's anybody's duty, it's everybody's duty. And if it's everybody's duty, then Mr. B ought to be paying for C as well. And obviously Mr. A should be paying. But you know what happened? Mr. B heard that Mr. C was going to the state and telling the state that it was somebody's duty to pay him. And Mr. B looked like and said, hey, I don't have as much as anybody else. But you know what? The next day he went to the state and he said, it's my right to have as much money as anybody else. Pay up. It's somebody's duty. So whose duty is it? Well, obviously, Mr. Z still has some more money, so we're going to take some of his money and give it to Mr. B. And Mr. A, well, he's got some more money, although not as much as Mr. Z, and we're going to give it to B.
Does Mr. B have the duty to pay for Mr. B?
Now, instinctively, you say no, because he's poorer. But what was the logic when C went to the government? Everybody has the duty. So maybe the money the government gives to C should now be reassigned to B. Oh, but don't you see what happened the very next day? A went there and he said, look, I'm just a little fed up. Everybody's taking my money. Now, let's be fair now. Equal opportunity and all that. If I don't have as much as anybody else, it's your duty to pay. Okay, but who's going to pay for Mr. A now? Well, obviously, poor Mr. Z, we're going to go down there again. We go to the well the third time on that guy because he's really rich. But Mr. A, we're beginning to wonder, well, he wasn't so bad off to begin with. Where does he get off saying the state has to pay for him? You see, it rubs us wrong when somebody who we think is not so bad off goes to the state. I want to know is, what's the difference between the claims? You say it's a difference of duty. But if it's anybody's duty, it's everybody's duty. And so now Z pays for A, B pays for A, and C pays for A. And I suppose the only person who can't go to the state would be Z because he's rich. But wait a minute. Why couldn't he go to the state too and say, hey, I'd like some help too. And here's the way I want you to help me. I want a protective tariff in my business. Okay? You see all these people that I'm helping down here? I want you to screen out this Japanese product that's coming into the country. I want you to put a real heavy tariff on it so that I can get by in my business a lot better. I want some protection. By the way, I wouldn't mind if you had regulations that would help keeping these guys who now have the money from going into business and competing with me. Okay, I've got a nice, rich oil industry going, and I don't want these little guys coming into the market. And so what I'd like from you, government, is to protect me. It's my right to make this money. And so now A, B, and C can't enter into the market because he's been protected. But is that fair to A, B, and C? Z says, was it fair to take my money to pay these people when they hadn't done anything for me? You begin to see the absolute mass of contradictions and an incredible job of the state to try to make everything fair. Well, the reason it can't make anything fair is because it began with the assumption that it was fair for Mr. C to use the power of the state to gain equality with Z, A, and B. And when you work up the line, you begin to see that once the state starts interfering in the marketplace in that way, it's not being fair to anybody. It must, in the nature of the case, favor some people over other people. And you say, well, that means it must favor the poor. Well, that isn't always the way beastly states work, sad to say. And moreover, as it turns out, it doesn't favor the poor. The state ends up favoring the rich. If you really want to get down to the heart of it, the rich end up winning because they ask for all sorts of protections from the state that make it impossible for other people to compete with them. Now, the issue here is not whether people should be poor, whether people should be rich, whether he's greedy, whether he really deserves this plight in life. The issue is whether the state is an equalizer among men. Has God given to the state the right to equalize men in terms of their economic powers? And for my money, I can't. Well, money? What do you mean that is? For my reading, I can't see that the law of God ever gives the state that right. And when the state starts to use that as though it were a right, it inherently becomes an unfair state favoring one group over another. Okay, now, I've already taken you far beyond our time, so I'm going to cycle questions just for a minute for the sake of answering the second issue. Then we will break, and then when we come back, I'll open up the floor completely. We've got to achieve a certain end here in my outline if we're going to make it through the week. On the second question, what is the place of the state in the order of creation, or the ordering of God? Romans 13, I've referred to already, is summarizing the state as an order of the sword, an order of coercion. Consequently, I do not believe that there would have been coercion prior to the sin of man. And so I don't believe the state is an order of creation. Now, but somebody argues there would have been a need for administration if there had been a large population. I don't buy that. I'm not sure why there would have been any need for administration either. Why would there have to be somebody, somebody's got to say what side of the street cars are going to go on. Why? Well, because if you don't, people are just going to do their own thing, and they're not going to watch out for others. In an unfallen world, they aren't going to watch out for others. And even if they don't, so what if people get in automobile collisions in an unfallen world? Death is no threat to these people. So, I mean, the whole thing is a bit speculative, isn't it? This idea that we have to have administration and order. Well, then, the only other argument that we have to take care of is, how come God didn't ordain the state immediately after the fall? Well, you can answer that in one of two ways. Either, in a sense, he did, because he told Eve that she was now going to be lorded over by her husband, a situation that would not have pertained in an unfallen world. And so the principle of hierarchy is introduced immediately, which then becomes, in civil categories, the state later on. Or you can say that God doesn't ordain the order of the state immediately, but he doesn't ordain the state at all until there's sin. He may have waited a few years, but he didn't ordain it before sin at all. And so it still shows, if you will, the providential or traditional Protestant view. Now, as to the Christological view, I make passing reference to it in my book, Theonomy and Christian Ethics. And at the time that I studied it, it just seemed to me that the New Testament studies, moving toward the view of the powers that I expounded for you, these studies are simply strange. That in each and every case, they can be understood in their own context as applying simply to a reference to demonic powers. And elsewhere, when the word ecclesia is used, it is the word used for governmental rulers. Somebody says, no, that word's always used for demonic powers. Well, that's just simply wrong. If you read the Septuagint of the Old Testament, that's a common word for the governmental officials in Babylon and elsewhere. And consequently, I'm not convinced by the linguistic study that powers must be as we've been told. Moreover, if we hold to that view, then we have to say that Paul had a very strange cosmology indeed. And do we want to say that when Paul was teaching this, he was only using a device that is only using a common outlook in his own day, the idea of cosmic powers behind the rulers? Or do we want to say that he actually believed it? If we're not convinced that that is a biblical cosmology, and I don't believe it is, then we have to say that Paul was not writing inerrantly. And since I believe Paul was writing inerrantly, and I don't hold to that cosmology, I have a hard time believing that it's a plausible view. However, the main thing is that linguistically there is no necessity for the view. And so I don't hold to the Christological view, although the application of the Christological view is attractive. The underlying view itself I don't find biblically convincing, and I do think that Romans 13 supports the providential view. Now, I'm saying these things, there's no need for you to believe anything I've said. I want you to understand that. We're in an area of controversy. You know very well that at the dinner table, you don't talk about politics. When you go to a party, you don't. Why is that? Because people tend to get very unhappy and upset with each other for their differences. I recognize you may have differences. After a 10-minute break and cooling down, we'll come back and let you ask some questions.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.